Welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Amalia.
And over here in her little bed with her little rocket pajamas.
And her fresh new haircut.
Lily Pie. And yeah, we're back. It's been a while. My original plan was to do Haunted Highgate, but I'm going to veer off another totally weird direction and talk about something known as the Subranians.
Sounds like a milkshake.
Why does it sound like a milkshake?
Not really like a milkshake. Cherry? No, I would say like a slushy that Sonic tries to do in the month of June.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah. I am going to be talking about some really cool, weird stories from the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, you were saying you were doing Bermuda Triangle. I got excited because it's something I've always thought is cool, but I've never, like, looked into it, to be honest.
I haven't done it in a while since I was a kid and they gave us computer access in fifth grade.
Used it wisely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd look that up and look up what celebrities married to who. So
they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
the two interests interlocked.
I feel like that's a typical thing that 10-year-olds look up, you know.
For sure.
Something weird and a celebrity fact.
There you go.
I mean, that's still what I look up to this day.
Okay, let's just get right into it.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. Kid, I mean, geography wasn't my strong suit. Still isn't, to be fair. And I thought every time we flew, I was going to be like, oh, really hope we're not going by the Bermuda Triangle. I hope the pilot knows.
Like, you thought it was pretty much just like a 50-50 chance that you're getting swallowed up by the Bermuda Triangle?
Yeah, and we're going to LA once when I was little. And I had just
like 16.
Learned. Yeah, yeah. 18. But I thought, uh-oh, is this going to be it? Are all my friends going to read a story about me next week that Bermuda Triangle got me?
Small jet.
I think we all kind of learned about Bermuda Triangle when we were kids at school, and it kind of fascinated me right away. I always wondered why this area is responsible for so many disappearances, mechanical failures, and all-around lore. So total, there have been 34 incidents in and around the Bermuda Triangle, but it mainly involves ships and planes. So I'll be diving into some of these stories. And another fun fact that I learned, Bermuda Triangle is also called the Devil's Triangle.
There's a lot of other triangles. It's mm-hmm. just kind of like a term used for like an area of
yeah.
weird things going on.
Mm-hmm. A lot of sites just say it's not really an agreed upon boundary. It is off the southeastern coast of the U.S. by Bermuda and Cuba, Jamaica, and Puerto Rico. It can make up anywhere between 500,000 and 1.5 million square miles, and it's kind of a triangle shape. One of the earliest reports of a strange occurrence that I found coming from the Bermuda Triangle is from the Dillweed himself, Columbus. Not gonna lie, I'm really disappointed in the Bermuda Triangle for not claiming this man's voyage. Would have really done us all a solid, my people especially. While traveling in the Atlantic Ocean, Dillweed wrote in his Pervy log about how the compasses were not working properly. And supposedly around 10 p.m. on October 11th, 1492, Dillweed was on the deck of the Santa Maria when he saw what he described as a glimmer in the distance. He stated, so small a body that he could not affirm it to be land. And he did write he for some reason in the journal. Whatever. serial killer. The light would vanish and reappear several times, and it would go up and down in the sky. Now, there were some reports that described the sighting as a fireball in the sky, but Dillweed said that it looked like a wax candle moving up and down, which I thought was strange.
Yeah, people will always describe it as whatever technology they have at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So one theory for the light source that they did see on the Santa Maria is that it was luminous worms called fire worms. They dance before the twice monthly quarter moon, and it also could have been a luminous squid. That's just their theory.
Like bioluminescent or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wonder if that could have been what he saw, but I don't know because they saw a fireball, so... Another disappearance that I actually had not heard of until this week that happened in the Devil's Triangle was the USS Cyclops. It disappeared on March 4th, 1918, carrying 306 crew and passengers. Now, this was a honking ship, 540 feet long and 65 feet wide. It is still the largest loss of life in the U.S. history that is not related to combat. The ship was carrying almost 11,000 tons of manganese ore, which is used to make steel. So this did happen during World War I. So a theory was the ship was sunk by enemy forces, but no countries ever claimed to have been responsible. The ship left Rio de Janeiro on February 16, 1918, and it was overloaded at that time. The ship made an unscheduled stop in Barbados because the water level was over the load line, which is the legal limit that a ship can be loaded for safety. The ship also had a cracked cylinder and it was not operative. The last message this ship sent said, "Weather fair, all well." And then 9 days into the voyage, the ship vanished and they did not even send out an SOS. Nothing was ever found from the ship, which is unusual for a ship of that size. The Office of Naval Intelligence looked into the Cyclops Captain Morley, and they found that he was basically an odd man. He was kind of a jerk, really, is how people described him. He would treat his staff bad, and he had very bad ethics. So he would put people in charge of jobs that did not have enough experience with that role. So one thing he did, which could have led to the ship's demise, is put somebody who was brand new in charge of loading cargo on the ship, which led to it being overloaded. They also found that he came to America from Germany, and they wondered if he could have been a German sympathizer. In 1969, an officer named Conrad Nervig talked of his experience on the Cyclops. Now, he got lucky, and he was transferred off the ship in Rio before it debarked for its ill-fated trip. He described the Captain Worley as rough, eccentric, salt of the old school, given to carrying a cane but possessing few other cultural attainments. He was a very indifferent seaman and a poor, overly cautious navigator, unfriendly. He was generally disliked by both his officers and men.
Maybe he like handed the ship over, huh?
I don't know. Conrad wonders if the ship disappeared due to a failed mutiny, or maybe it was capsized or manganese. I hope I'm saying it right. Maybe he wonders if it exploded or a giant octopus destroyed the ship.
A little krakened.
Yeah. I wonder if it was an octopus.
Giant sea monster swallowed it up. That's no weirder than the Bermuda Triangle.
Now, oddly enough, about 20-some years later in 1941, the USS Proteus was lost with all 58 persons on board in heavy seas, also in the Bermuda Triangle. And the following month, her sister ship, the USS Nereus, was lost with all 61 persons on board. They were all sister ships to the USS Cyclops.
What does sister ships kind of mean?
Now, a sister ship is a ship of the same class or virtually identical design.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there was a fault in the design. Yeah. If they're all the ones that are disappearing.
Yeah. They kind of had a theory that they weren't built properly. Mm. So, but it's weird.
Yeah. Weird that they've never found any sort of remnants or whatever.
Mm-mm. Now moving on to some weird plane stories. On October 30th, 1954, flight 441 was on its way to Azores. It carried 32 Navy persons, 8 civilians who were family members, and 2 airmen. The plane was supposed to be one of the greatest of its time. Messages from the plane stopped around 11:30 p.m., and it was estimated the craft was 400 miles off the coast. There was no SOS call sent out, and the plane's cargo did have life rafts that would have floated up if the plane crashed and broke apart, but no trace has ever been found. It is considered one of the weirdest Devil's Triangle's mysteries. The search for the plane and the passengers was one of the largest ever launched. There was 260 airplanes, 27 ships covering 1,000 square miles of the ocean daily for 2 weeks. There was 16,000 people from the Navy, Coast Guard, and Air Force who were also assisted in the search. Nothing. Never found anything.
Weird.
Mm-hmm.
And the last report, little thing they did was right before Halloween.
That's true.
Because it was October 30th, 11:30 p.m.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. As soon as Halloween hit in the Devil's Triangle.
In 2017, an MU-2B private aircraft carrying a woman, her partner, and 2 children, and the pilot lost contact with air traffic near the Bermuda Triangle, and no survivors were ever found. A search crew found oil slicks and debris, but no bodies.
Oh. They did find oil slicks, though.
Yeah, they found oil slicks. They're not sure if it could have been that plane, but they think, like, they can't prove it. So what's weird is the pilot was experienced, and he had served as a Coast Guard auxiliary pilot from 2005 to 2014. At the time the plane was in the air, there was a thunderstorm warning that was issued, and they also warned pilots at icy conditions at the altitude that the plane was in. The weather alerts would have been available to the pilot before he took off for his destination. So
he felt like it wasn't overly dangerous then, obviously.
Yeah. So the last weird story I have is that of the SS Cotopaxi, which vanished in 1925. The ship left Charleston, South Carolina around November 29th, and it was bound for Havana with coal on cargo and a crew of 32. Around December 1st, they radioed a distress call that the ship was sinking during a tropical storm. The ship was never seen again. But in the 80s, the wreckage of a ship was found 35 miles from St. Augustine, Florida, and they nicknamed it the Bear Wreck. They wondered for years if this could be the Cotopaxi. Then, in 2020, they were finally able to confirm that the Bear Wreck was the SS Cotopaxi, and they believe the ship sank due to negligence mixed with bad maintenance and a storm. But no crew was ever found.
Hmm. No remnants of any bodies, huh?
No.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird. That's almost weirder that they found it, and then there was no, like, people...
Mm-hmm.
At all.
Yeah. I think out of all of them, the Flight 441 is the strangest to me.
The Halloween one?
Mm-hmm.
Just with the exhaustive efforts, too, of, like, trying to find any sort of sign.
Mm-hmm.
That is really strange.
To have 16,000 different people help with this search. And I actually found the news story on newspapers.com. I got to see, and they had the pictures of everybody that had been lost that they were looking for.
Whoa.
So these are just some of the weird stories that I found, and I hope to do a part two sometime soon. And if there's a certain disappearance or weird story you know of, please send it our way.
I've got an old documentary, I think, from like 1976 for you that I have not watched yet.
Ooh.
About the Bermuda Triangle. So I'm sure that'll send you down maybe some rabbit holes you haven't hit yet.
I'm excited to see what they say about the SS Cotopaxi, since they would have didn't even know yet that it, I mean, it wasn't discovered until the 80s. So
I want to look more into it now, too. Super weird. So today, I'm going to be veering off from Haunted Highgate. I got to get out of that cemetery for a little while.
For your own mental health.
I'm definitely going to come back to it someday. But this is where I'm at right now.
Uh-oh.
I'm heading to Mount Rainier and the encounter with the old man in the crater. I found this on bizarrebigfoot.blogspot.com at first, which has the whole story that's from the Challenge of Rainier by D. Molinar. And then that book is just a bunch of mountaineer exploration stories of people climbing to the summit. And then it has this tale within the book. This is an account from Edward Sturgis Ingram. Let's start with some of his credentials.
Yeah,
please. He was the first superintendent of Seattle Public Schools. He was a mountaineer who climbed up the summit of Rainier 13 times and was a leader in the effort to establish Mount Rainier National Park. Yeah, there's a high school named after him, and there's the Ingram Glacier on Mount Rainier.
So a very unaccomplished person.
Yeah, very unaccomplished.
Yeah.
Not someone you'd want to listen to.
Yeah.
They were telling you a story.
Not somebody you take seriously.
No. Okay, so that's pretty much what you can find, like, on Wikipedia. And there's a bunch of stuff about him.
What zodiac sign is he?
I don't know. I've actually found that book on the Internet Archive. Edward is an Aries. And did you notice I almost said archive instead of archive? Okay, back to it. The Challenge of Rainier book, and like was looking at it a bit, and he's all through the early part. He was like some of the first people to document their climbs to the summit, you know, of Mount Rainier. So it's pretty wild.
Okay.
But that's not what we're here for. We're here for his experience, or at least his writing, of the old man in the crater. So I'm going to do something a little different today. I'm going to read a section of what he wrote. And then we'll stop and we'll dissect it together a little bit.
Mm.
I think I kept saying the old man in the crater. I think it's actually the old man of the crater. But it says Major E. S. Ingram. And this is 1895.
Oh.
While my companion and I were exploring the steam caves at the times of my second visit to the crater of Mount Rainier, I noticed peculiar marks and scratching on the floor of the cave. In some places, the ground appeared as though it had been the scene of a conflict between some maddened beasts. So extensive was the disturbance. In other places, there were depressions that might have been made by some flat-footed animal pawing in the earth. My curiosity was deeply excited. The lower we descended into the cave, the more frequent by less marked became those scratching. Now let me make a note. This is written in 1895, so I'm going to struggle through some of it. As the sunlight from without became dim, I noticed a peculiar soft glow in the atmosphere of the cave, hardly perceptible, that might have been produced by either light or heat, but it was probably brought about by the presence of some force more subtle than either. I also felt a peculiar sensation in the body, such as a person feels when standing upon an insulated stool with his hand holding the pole of an electrical machine slightly charged. Whether my companion noticed these startling phenomena, I do not know. If he did, he, like myself, remained silent upon the subject. The situation was extremely interesting to one of scientific mind and invited investigation. But I suggested to my companion a return to the outer world. Within my own mind, I decided to revisit the cave alone later. So I found a really interesting article from 2014 about a group of scientists exploring the crater. They dubbed the Colosseum on Mount Rainier's summit. So the article's called Under Mount Rainier's Crater, a Natural Laboratory Like No Other. The article is super interesting. I will link it. Highly recommended. In the article, it says the first recorded ascent to the summit was August 17th, 1870. So Edward's account would have been only 25 years later. Now, in the mountaineering book, it talks about Edward with these same people that were like the first people. So he was in like the groups of people in the very, very beginning. So that's all legit. The article also mentions that Boeing and the Defense Department picked the summit for a secret experiment in 1959 to simulate life on a lunar base. A report noted dryly, "It seems hardly necessary to look elsewhere on this Earth for more severe environmental conditions."
Ooh.
So this place is like crazy. Steam caves, ice everywhere, crazy storms and weather up at the summit that like a lot of people die from just trying to do this stuff. And the scientists in this article were like trapped in this crazy storm. And like most of the time people back then during this time, Ingram's time, they would just kind of hide in there from the weather when they were trying to get up the summit. They weren't necessarily exploring the caves. Some of them have dangerous gases in them and all sorts of stuff. So this is pretty weird and legit, is what I found kind of so far, at least. Back to Edward's story. Late at night, when my three bedfellows were sound asleep, I cautiously crawled from under the scanty covering and was soon in the cave again. While it was intensely dark within and cold without, the warmth of the steam cave soon restored my benumbed body to an unusual degree of comfort, and my sleepy senses resumed. Slowly groping my way along the floor of the cave, I was soon within the influence of the mysterious glow I had noticed upon my first descent. The situation was weird and startling. Midnight in a crater. The vaulted sky above you, the only familiar object, with the hot rocks and hissing steam around you suggesting what once was and what may be again. To leave my sleeping companions and the last familiar object, to descend toward the source of the heat and steam, to go down, down toward the earth's hot interior, all tended to try my nerves and fill my mind with strange forebodings. While my prudence and caution would cause me to return to my companions and leave the mysteries of the cave unsolved, I still cautiously groped my way onward. The sense of feeling became strangely acute. I could readily keep in the center of the cave by extending my hand to either side and noting change of temperature caused by the adjacent ice walls. The mysterious influence of a still more mysterious force enabled me to know my surroundings quite distinctly. As before stated, these steam caves seemed to radiate from the center of the crater, a single passage branching into two or more as it nears the rim of the crater. I had reached a point where another passage joined, or more properly separated from the one I was following, when I was startled by a noise, followed by several stones rolling down the tributary passage. Had my companion of the first visit noticed the mysterious things I had, and was like myself seeking to discover their cause? I quickly stepped within a recess in the wall of ice on my left and awaited developments. So Edward decides to go back to the cave. He's pretty much being beckoned, right?
Yeah.
Why would you go into a cave? He has companions.
Almost being lured.
Like, why would you go into a creepy steam cave at midnight? But also, like, he's already a daring explorer. So mm-hmm. let's get that straight.
Yeah. Right?
He's chasing this feeling, this mysterious force he keeps talking about. And as he's getting deeper into the cave, it's, of course, pitch black. And he's just feeling his way through. He says groping his way through the cave. It's getting tighter and tighter as it goes. But he's being led by this force. He says, the mysterious influence of a still more mysterious force enabled me to know my surroundings quite distinctly. So he still kind of knew where he was at, even though it was pitch black.
Yeah.
To me, this really rings true to this thing we hear about in every kind of case, and I'll say my own personal experiences, this overwhelming knowing that you're supposed to do something,
mm-hmm.
or as you said earlier, luring,
mm-hmm.
comes to a kind of fork in the passage. He describes it in a weird way, and then he hears a noise. He says, I had reached a point where another passage joined, or more properly separated from the one I was following, when I was startled by a noise, followed by several stones rolling down the tributary passage. By the way, tributary, probably saying that wrong, means a stream that flows into a larger stream or other body of water. So, like a little passage.
I never knew that.
I had to look it up because I had no idea. So now we got a strange noise that isn't really described. And we got some stone throwing. And we get a lot of that in Bigfoot reports.
And Kushtaka.
All the way back in episode 2, you talked about a lot of this. It's in the title.
Yeah.
Hucking stones.
Yeah.
So we know that that's a thing that the other likes to do.
Mm-hmm. The cryptid cuties.
Then he wonders, you know, did my friend also get the same feeling and
yeah.
do what I'm doing? So he kind of hides, pops into the recess of an ice wall. He kind of hides and he just watches. Okay, let's press on with Edward. I had not long to wait, for almost immediately there came, now rolling, now making an attempt to crawl, a figure of strange and grotesque appearance down the passage. It stopped within a few feet of me, writhing and floundering, very much as a drowning man would do, when drawn from the water that he was about to sink in for the last time. Its shape was nearer that of a human being than of any other animal. The crown of its head was pointed, with bristled hair pointing in every direction. The eyeballs were pointed too, and while they appeared dull and visionless at times, there was an occasional flash of light from the points, which increased in frequency and brilliancy as the owner began to revive. The nails of its fingers and toes were long and pointed and resembled polished steel more than hardened cuticle. I discovered that the palms of its hands and the soles of its feet were hard and calloused. In fact, the whole body, while human in shape, except the pointedness of the parts I have mentioned, seemed very different in character from that of the human species. There was something about the mysterious being, however, that would make it possible that its ancestry of long ages ago might have been human beings like ourselves. Yet by living in different surroundings and under entirely different conditions, many of its characteristics had changed. So that's pretty terrifying, first off.
It's like the people from the Time Machine.
What year was that? Go ahead and look into it.
Time Machine came out in 1895.
Interesting.
Yeah, they called them Morlocks. They were ape-like cavemen who live in the darkness underground and surface only at night.
Interesting. I like that. So first he sees this thing crawl toward him in the dark. Terrifying. Called it strange and grotesque and described it as writhing and floundering very much as a drowning man would do when drawn from the water he was about to sink in for the last time. That kind of sounds almost like a not used to breathing whatever air or whatever, you know,
yeah.
like a fish out of water. Now, I'm not sure if that's like a description of like eye shine or something otherworldly about the light in the eyes.
Yeah.
but the nails were long and pointed and said to look like polished steel more than hardened cuticle. That was pretty interesting.
That's weird.
The hands and soles of the feet are calloused, and he describes the whole shape to be very humanish, and even says that it seems like it could have been shared an ancestor with people, but grew to its surroundings in a very different environment. Very interesting. You know, some folks have compared this creature to Bigfoot, of course, the pointed head, you know, kind of ape-like, the bristled hair, calloused feet and hands, but the pointed eyes, the floundering behavior, the super long nails sound a bit different to me.
Yeah.
And it's about to get a lot weirder. By degrees, this strange being began to revive. Gradually, an electric glow covered the entire body with light centers at the ends of those pointed nails, the eyes, and the top of the head. It seemed to accomplish its revivification by rubbing its hands vigorously together. As soon as it was able to stand, it began to rub its feet rapidly on the floor of the cave. This increased the glow of its body and caused the light centers to shine with increased brilliancy. It seemed to receive some vital fluid from the earth that at once gave new vigor to its whole system. Involuntarily, I imitated its actions and immediately found myself undergoing a very peculiar sensation. I seemed to be growing in accord with the strange being, who then for the first time noticed my presence. He at once redoubled his former movements. He would rub his hands vigorously together and then quickly extend the points of his fingers in my direction when sparks of light would dart therefrom.
What? Like from his fingers?
Yeah. Having become deeply interested in this strange exhibition, I went through the same maneuver with a similar result, although apparently in a much lesser degree. The effect was magical. I was becoming in rapport with the old man of the crater. I could see a brilliant point of light gradually forming on the crown of his head. Feeling my own hair beginning to rise, I removed my knit cap and felt my hair bristling upward to a common point. The light from his crown seemed to form an arc above and between us, and we were in communication. There, in that icy passage connecting the unknown interior of this earth with the exterior by means of a new medium, or rather an old medium newly applied, two intelligent beings of different races were enabled to communicate, imperfectly at first, of course, with each other. So, now it's getting really weird. The being begins to glow, specifically in the weird points.
Yeah.
The crown of the head, the eyes, and the pointed nails. It then starts doing this interesting movement, rubbing its hands together and rubbing its feet together, almost getting like static electricity going on. And this increased the glow of its body and caused the light centers to shine with increased brilliancy. So these points on the head and the eyes and on the nails, as he's doing it, they're getting brighter and brighter as he's doing these weird rubbing movements. Then all of a sudden, Edward involuntarily starts also doing the same movements. This is very OA to me, by the way, with the movements.
Oh,
imagine them all doing the movements. So Edward's now in the cave, rubbing his hands and feet, doing the same thing and pointing and also getting some light kind of coming, but to a lesser degree. And then he starts feeling this like prickly electric sensation on his head. He removes his hat and his hair starts going up like staticky. And then there's just this big arch of light going between him and this being, this electrical light from their heads. And now they're in communication.
Oh.
This is the coolest visual explanation of telepathic communication I've ever heard.
That's true.
Now, in that article, about the explorers. There's a really weird part. They were talking about this crazy storm. When tent poles and metal stoves started buzzing, Loki and the other climbers looked around in alarm. Microbiologist Zoe Harold's hair stood up on end in the electrically charged atmosphere. That's pretty weird, huh?
Yeah.
I was like, that's kind of weird, actually.
It's like when lightning's about to strike.
They all talk about the electric feel in the air in that place.
Ooh.
So Edward's not lying about that.
Yeah.
All right, back to the crazy. For an hour, I received impressions from the old man of the crater. It is a strange story I got from him. While the time was comparatively short, yet what he told me, not by voice or look, but by a subtle agency not known or understood by me, would fill a volume of many pages. Finally, expressing doubt at what he communicated, he commanded me to follow him. I had anticipated such a demand and was ready to resist it. So when he turned to descend to the hot interior of the earth, as I verily believe, by a superhuman effort, I broke the spell and hastened upward and back to my sleeping companions. This is no myth. The old man told me of his abode in the interior, of another race to which he belonged, and the traditions of that race, of convulsions and changes on the earth long, long ago, of the gradual contraction of a belt of matter around the earth until it touched the surface, hemming in many of the inhabitants and drowning the remainder, and of the survival of a single pair. All was shut out, and the atmosphere became changed. Gradually, this remaining pair was enabled to conform to the new order of things and become the parents of a race, which, for want of a better name, I will call Subranians. This old man of the crater had wandered far away from the abode of his race in his desire to explore. Far away from my home, we had met, each out of his usual sphere. That's it. That's Edward's story. He's receiving impressions from the old man through this strange light arc of communication. He says, what he told me, not by voice or look, but by a subtle agency not known or understood by me, would fill a volume of pages. You hear that a lot with the telepathic stuff.
Yeah.
That it's not necessarily like words
mm-hmm.
or even pictures. It's like a knowing, like just processing, just like getting all this information.
Almost processing your own thoughts.
And he's trying his best to explain it. And I find that really interesting in 1895. Edward finally is like, I'm not so sure you're telling me the truth. Even though he's going through this really amazing experience, he's starting to not trust whatever's doing this. The old man commanded Edward to go with him. And he says, I had anticipated such demand and was ready to resist it. So when he turned to descend to the hot interior of the earth, as I verily believe, by a superhuman effort, I broke the spell and hastened upward and back to my sleeping companions. He broke the spell. He started to realize that he was in some sort of trance or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the old man was going to try to take him down into the interior of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, he knew not to do it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of trance-like things going on throughout the entire experience. This kind of beckoning. You even said alluring mm-hmm. in the beginning. I think you were on to something there. From an unknown force that he talks about all the time. He sees this terrifying creature and he doesn't run or scream. He just watches.
Mm-hmm.
Then he involuntarily starts doing the movements that in turn create the arc of communication. So he also says, this old man of the crater had wandered far away from the abode of his race in his desire to explore. I wonder if the old man felt the same strange urge to venture out by an unknown force.
Mm.
Was that just like the Edward Sturgis Ingram of a mere kind of world of like that guy, instead of like climbing up a great summit, he's climbing up from the interior of the earth.
Yeah.
And they're both meeting at like this same place and they're both explorers.
Yeah.
And yeah, I kind of started getting tripped out thinking about that.
Or to quote Megan Fox, twin flames.
They very much might be twin flames. I like that. Or was he a trickster leading the man to the other place? Important to note, you know, I have no idea how like legit this is. Maybe he just was like trying to write a science fiction book.
Mm-hmm.
And someone found like the start of his idea of a story. But it's 100% true that he climbed to Mount Rainier many, many times,
mm-hmm.
and was one of the early explorers documenting these caves and one of the early people that actually was going in to the caves. So, but I will say, Jules Verne, Journey to the Center of the Earth came out in 1864. You talked about
Time Machine,
1895. So science fiction stuff was popular at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe he was a fan. I don't know. But Mount Rainier's known for weirdness.
Yeah.
Bat Squatch, Kenneth Arnold sighting. There's a lot of weird stuff. So at first I was kind of trying to like verify the legitness of this. And then I was like, I don't want to. But it is in that Mount Rainier mountaineering book.
Mm-hmm.
It's in there. So if any listeners want to look more into this and ruin it for me, that would be just fine. But for now, I'm going to leave it at Seattle's first superintendent met a subterranean explorer and telepathically communicated with them for an hour about their history through a light arc, before catching on that they may be a trickster leading them into fairyland for a possible time loss adventure in the center of the earth, breaking their spell and heading back to camp as if nothing happened. Sounds pretty legit to me. At the end of a lot of episodes, I've just been using the random story function on the liminal earth map at liminal.earth, reading that kind of in real time before ending the show. So Amalia, why don't you do it today? It's fun to do this, not only because there's just really cool, weird stories, but also sometimes there's been some synchronicities with it. So
this one is called White River, tagged Mythology's Straight Up Ghosts. Fourth grade classroom desk slides across the floor at least a few feet. Stories of the school being haunted. Ghost stories in all parts of this little town I grew up in. Just across the state highway is Rosebud Reservation. There's a weekly world news article about old Sioux warriors killing or finding a devil skull with horns. These days it seems believable. Native stories of deer woman and giants. I lived outside of the town on some land that happened to be very active and would hear footsteps and objects moving around. Even find arrowhead-shaped rocks outside after the rain. I would have bad dreams and my brother would hear things moving in his closet and once felt his pillow press in like someone sat next to him. I've also had my game system turn off and the TV after. Dogs barking at nothing. Weird shadow sightings and noises on outside of home. Other ghost stories around town and older homes, especially along the river. Faces and voices in the trees by the river and haunted homes. Paranormal place for sure. The whole state and history. Caves, springs, badlands. Black Hills, the Lakota. Submitted by Dirt Bath. This was submitted on December 8th, 2022 in South Dakota, White River.
I feel like it was saying,
my brethren, we got a story for you. It's going to knock your socks off. Come, my sister.
They even mentioned Dear Woman.
I know.
Which you did a section on.
Yeah.
In an old episode. I can't remember what one, but
yeah.
Very cool.
That's section. So funny.
That's very interesting. There's been a couple times where I've done it, and there's been some interesting synchronicities.
Yeah.
So.
We're recording this at night, so thanks for the bedtime story. Gonna be terrified tonight.
Not to mention, there was a creak in the closet right before you read the part about noises in the closet.
Yeah.
No, that's pretty cool. We should do that. I've just been doing it at the end of, like, rabbit holes with guests. But, yeah, shout out Liminal Earth.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you haven't got to see the random story function.
No.
Because I've been doing that as edit John.
Yeah.
So it's kind of more fun to just do it live with each other like that. So
yeah. That's
what we'll do from now on. All right. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. If you enjoy what you heard today, consider supporting the show. The best way to do that is to go to anomalouswaves.com. It has all the stuff. It has links to our Patreon, our merch store. There's even a little tip jar down at the bottom.
I dare you. A double dog dare you.
Or you can go to patreon.com/anomalouswaves. You can join for as little as $1 a month and get some extra bonus goods. And we've got some cool things coming. As always, make sure and check the show notes for links relevant to today's episode. All right, that's it. Thanks so much for listening. We'll have another episode very soon. We're going to make a lot more this year. All right, bye.
Gulashish. Lily Pet.